loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, today marks the one-year anniversary of the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel. Mueller was supposed to investigate allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. There hasn't been any such evidence so far provided, but the investigation has broadened into a case that has implicated dozens of people. We're going to take the occasion of this anniversary to talk about where the Mueller probe is, there's some new developments, and also where it's going and what it means for politics in the United States and around the globe. And then today we continue our weekly series. It's every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, 20,000 teachers across the state of North Carolina have gone on strike, shutting schools in 40 districts to cancel classes for more than a million students. In a familiar refrain, the teachers want better benefits and higher salaries, which have declined 9.4% in the past decade in real terms. Next, dramatic changes are underway in Malaysia as new Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad takes office. Police raided Mahathir's predecessor, Najib Razak's home, and longtime opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim has been released from prison. Then President Trump and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin will meet with Chinese Vice Premier Yu He to discuss trade. The meetings are meant to prevent trade tensions from spiraling into a trade war, a possibility since the administration imposed sanctions on Chinese goods. And then a Ukrainian diplomat in Hamburg, Germany has been suspended after posting virulently anti-Semitic remarks on Facebook. Vasil Marushchinets wrote that Jews were responsible for World War II and ended the post with, quote, "death to the anti-fascists," unquote. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko condemned the remarks, but he recently signed into law a measure that glorifies Ukrainians who collaborated with the Nazis. And finally, the Senate yesterday passed a non-binding resolution nullifying the Federal Communications Commission's net neutrality rollback. The 52-47 vote is a symbolic blow to the FCC, but the net neutrality revocation remains on track to take effect next month.
And in other headlines, the Senate has just voted to confirm Gina Haspel, or Bloody Gina, as the new CIA director. The vote came after yesterday's 10-5 decision by the Senate Intelligence Committee to give Haspel a positive recommendation. Haspel has been strongly criticized around the world for her role in the Bush-era CIA torture program. The Pentagon spokesperson, Dana White, said today that there are no plans to change or stop military drills on North Korea's border. These drills started May 11th and involve 100 planes, including B-52 bombers. North Korea canceled a meeting with representatives of the South as a consequence of these exercises. A volcano in Hawaii spewed ash and chunks of magma 30,000 feet into the air this morning at 4:15 a.m. on the island, which is 10:15 a.m. Eastern. Schools, residents, and geologists were all evacuated, and the U.S. Geological Survey even reports an aviation alert due to the height of the ash, which can damage jet engines. Explosions like this one can shoot ballistic blocks the size of refrigerators half a mile long. The Pope promised today that changes would be made to the Chilean Catholic Church following a massive sex abuse scandal. However, there's been no promise of sanctions or punishment for the men who committed the abuse or the cardinal whose victims say primarily covered up the scandal. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion on the one-year anniversary of the Mueller investigation.
Loud and clear.
Now we turn to the anniversary. Yes, it's the one-year anniversary of the appointment of Robert Mueller as special counsel. Mueller was supposed to investigate allegations of alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. There hasn't been any such evidence presented so far, nor indictments about it. But the investigation has broadened into a case that has implicated dozens of people. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we're joined from New York City by Ted Rawl. He is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Ted and Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
Happy anniversary, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's 1 year. It's been really a stellar performance in American politics. Anyway, let's just talk first, big picture. Ted Rawl, What do you think about when you think about this has been going on for 1 year?
I think about the fact that in New York City, I walk by homeless people who don't know if they're going to be able to survive long enough because they don't get enough to eat. And I think about all the money that has gone into this. And I don't even mean just the money that's been spent on Mueller and his team. I mean all the advertising dollars, all the cable TV hours that have been spent that could have been spent talking about real problems. Look, we don't know what Mueller has found. That's true. We have to make that. But so far, it's been singularly unimpressive. It just seems like a colossal waste of time. There has been absolutely no evidence of collusion between Trump's 2016 campaign and the Russian government that has come to light so far. And it looks like the arrests and the searches and everything else have come down to what anyone with common sense probably could have figured out, that Trump's kind of a sleaze and that he's surrounded by sleazy people. We really didn't need to spend all this time and money and energy and political energy into something that was so self-evident.
Yeah, Donald Trump tweeted, "Congratulations, America. We are now into the second year of the greatest witch hunt in American history. There is still no collusion and no obstruction. The only collusion was that done by the Democrats, who were unto win an election despite the spending of far more money." Well, that's tweet obviously has some grammatical flaws in it, or spelling problems, or whatever. But Jim Kavanaugh, this is not the greatest witch hunt in American history, but is it a witch hunt?
Yeah, it's not the greatest, but I think it is a political witch hunt in the sense that, you know, they're trying to find crimes to stitch up the man. And, you know, they probably will. There will probably be, as Ted suggested, crimes that of financial chicanery and money laundering and whatever. I'd be extremely surprised if none of that isn't Donald Trump's resume. But it is, as Ted, I just absolutely second what Ted said, it's an absolute political waste of time. The issues that we face, war and peace, poverty, health care, whether we're going to go to war with Iran, what we're going to do with this insane Israeli government, and the justice for the Palestinians, and all of this goes by the wayside while we reams and reams of newsprint and digital print on this stuff. So yes, Donald Trump is probably guilty of some kind of crime, and they may find it. But it is, again, I'll say from my point, the big picture, the substitution of litigation for politics. What they can't win politically, they go after via litigation. And it could have been. It's the kind of crime that you could find almost anywhere in Washington, if you sought it. It's the Democrats' version of what the Republicans did to Bill Clinton, a more massive scale, I think, essentially. And they're going to indict some people for lying to the prosecutor and for money laundering and for paying people off and bribery. And it's going to go on for another year with these kinds of allegations.
And I think we should not trick ourselves into thinking that this thing is almost over. There's a terrific piece at 538.com today that compares this special counsel investigation with previous special counsel and special prosecutor investigations. So this one has gone on for a year. But if you look back at earlier investigations, Watergate went for more than 4 years. Iran-Contra went for 6.5 years. The Samuel Pierce influence peddling scandal during President George H.W. Bush's administration, 8.5 years. Whitewater, 7.5. Mike Espy, 7.5. Henry Cisneros perjury charges, 8.5 years. Even Valerie Plame went for more than 3 years.
So we have 7 more years of Mueller, the Mueller probe?
You know what? It's possible. We really don't know. But if the past is any guide, this thing has years to go before it's fully played out.
Ted Rall, the Salem witch hunt in 1692 and 1693 led to the execution of 40 women. So that was worse. That was definitely worse. Then there was the witch hunt of the Palmer raids after World War One, where 10,000 socialists were expelled from the country and thousands more. There was the American witch hunt after World War II during the Cold War, where anti-socialism and anti-communism became the unofficial religion of America, and people went to prison because of their beliefs, their ideas. So Donald Trump's wrong about it being the worst witch hunt, but it is a witch hunt because it's got that element of an article of faith. The Russians colluded with Trump. The Russians are spreading chaos. The Russians are really messing with America. And even though there's actually no hard evidence, a huge part of the population, especially those who supported Hillary Clinton, actually believe it to be true, including a lot of people who used to be opponents of James Comey, Robert Mueller, the FBI, people who I've known for a long time who would have said, if the FBI comes to your door, don't answer it. Be aware of the FBI and all the things that they can do to trap you. It's been a sea change politically.
It has. It's a, you know, it's a conspiracy theory at this point. And conspiracy theories tend to arise out of things that are unexplained. After Germany lost World War One, the Nazis and other right-wing groups exploited that surprising loss by claiming that a conspiracy that Jews had were somehow responsible for a stab in the back to Germany. After 9/11, the inexplicable ability of 19 guys with knives to pull off so much chaos and damage gave rise to all sorts of conspiracy theories concerning the destruction of the World Trade Center. And so people are always looking for when they don't want to accept what really happened. For example, one crazy guy in Dallas in a book warehouse killed the president of the United States. They look for more interesting, bigger, grandiose schemes. Somehow there must be a bigger power involved here. I think that's what happened with the Hillary Clinton people. They just can't accept the fact that they woke up on election morning in November 2016, reading that she had a 90% chance of winning the election, and then had that 90% chance not happen by that evening. It still freaks them out. Everyone told them that the results would be different. Reality, of course, we have the reality now. But it does seem like this is mostly, in large part, I should say, it has to do with the inability of people to accept the fact that she was an atrocious candidate with a terrible campaign.
Now we have the, Jim, the Senate, it was the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday met with Brennan and Hayden and I don't know who else, the other leaders of the intelligence agency, what's called the intelligence community, which is kind of funny, the intelligence agencies during the Obama era. And the Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee came out and said, yeah, Russia did interfere in the 2016 election and Russia favored Trump, which was quite an admission. Now, that part isn't, you know, a huge surprise to me. I mean, every government in the world has a favorite when there's a U.S. presidential campaign. I met with Cubans before the 2008 election. They were kind of hoping Obama would win. I was kind of skeptical about the Democrats and the Republicans, but they were thinking like, no, if Obama wins, maybe something good will happen in terms of U.S.-Cuban relations. They certainly didn't think that was going to happen with John McCain. Now you have Donald Trump, who is saying, let's have better relations with Russia during the 2016 campaign. To Russians, I don't know if it's the Russian government, but certainly to people who are Russian, that would sound better than Hillary Clinton's message, which was, you know, gird up for a confrontation with Russia. But again, what we see is a bipartisan effort that's targeting Russia. And it seems to me that this, I agree with Ted in one way, in one important way, which is I think the genesis or the origin of this was largely motivated by Hillary Clinton and the Democrats' inability to explain their inexplicable loss to the most unpopular candidate in American history. That would be Donald Trump. But it also has mushroomed into or intersected with this other larger strategic reorientation of American foreign policy that is now targeting Russia for confrontation. And I believe in a way, whatever its genesis, whatever its origin, we're in a new era.
Yes, I believe you're right. And I think that the targets of this are not Donald Trump per se, but Russia in a geostrategic sense and American political dissidents in a domestic sense. I think the Clintonians and the Clintonite Democratic Party, to call it that, was furious at their loss. They know Trump is very unpopular, too. he lost the popular vote. And they used this during the campaign. And after their campaign, they found that they sought a way both to proceed politically without taking up the issues that the progressive left had raised during and the Bernie campaign had raised during the campaign, and at the same time increase the pressure and push the country further in the direction of aggression towards Russia. So this was part of both of those things. It was part of leaving behind or of diverting from the politics that the progressive base of the Democratic Party showed it wanted, and creating a political campaign for the next 4 years or 8 years that would be directed towards nothing but getting Trump out of office and towards increasing pressure for aggression against Russia and bringing up all sanctions against all kinds of people and all kinds of things that previously had been, you know, Obama had good relations with Russia and scoffed Mitt Romney for saying anything else. But now something has changed, and the Russians have given some resistance to American plans in Syria and in Ukraine, and that is something that has to be corrected as far as they're concerned.
I want to ask Ted Rall, too. So many people complain about even the nature of this investigation. They complain about the nature, they complain about the pace, about the cost, about the focus. Why is it that no one has begun drafting legislation to really restrict the focus of these special counsel investigations? There's no reason, in my view, for an investigation to last for 5 years or 8 years or whatever it ends up running, and then costing tens of millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money, only to then result in these so-called throwaway felonies, making a false statement, perjury, obstruction, silly things that are then negotiated down to misdemeanors frequently. Why hasn't Congress acted on this?
You know, that's such an interesting question, and you can only speculate. I mean, on the one hand, you could easily imagine a world where the Democrats and the Republicans got together and said, listen, these special counsel investigations have been a drain on both of us. Why don't we just both agree to get rid of them? And they could. They could modify they could pass a law, and that would be the end of it. They could certainly limit the scope, as you said. On the other hand, I mean, so since they don't do that, I'm assuming that what's really going on is that each party has a sort of a hubris. The leadership thinks, well, we can use this to greater effect when we're in power, and we'll always get in power. It's kind of a variation of how in the Obama era there was talk about how Republicans were never going to run Congress again and would never run an election, would never win the White House again, and the Democrats would become the permanent majority party. That hubris, you know, I think maybe that's it. It's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, how about you, Jim?
I think this is part of the toolkit for doing what I said. It's another way of diverting from the political and diverting from having to convince the populace of policies that you want, okay? So like the Senate, like a bicameral legislature, like the Supreme Court, these are ways that, but this is another thing. It's something that if we have the authority, we can throw up this as an impediment to an administration from doing things we don't want, that puts constant pressure on them and diverts their energies. Now, you know, I'm glad, nothing against diverting Trump's political energies, but it doesn't really work that way, but it just creates a tremendous political pressure on him, and it does create pressure, for example, to maintain aggression against Russia. So it's something that they either have to agree to give up as a tool for exerting political pressure through litigation in a very dramatic way, or they each want to have it to pull out whenever they want to use it, whenever they're in a position to use it. And I think they don't want to forego it yet.
One of the big surprises for Mueller came in the last weeks, because one of the indicted entities among the Russians who have been indicted, that indictment of 13 Russian individuals and companies, one of them, Concord, has actually, and this surprised Mueller because he figured, well, the Russians aren't going to come. The indictment was basically a public relations ploy, because if it's not going to trial, you don't have to really prove your case, right? And he figured, well, the Russians aren't going to come to an American court. Well, guess what? One of them did come. That's Concord Management. Two lawyers from the D.C. law firm Reed Smith came into court, and they entered a not guilty plea. And then they're demanding that the court set a speedy trial date. And they want, through discovery, to see what Mueller has, what the evidence is, what the foundation is of the indictment. And I don't think Ted Rall and Jim Kavanaugh, I don't think Mueller expected any Russians to come to court and thus didn't have to reveal what's the foundation of these indictments. These were, again, as John mentioned, throwaway convictions. Well, these were kind of throwaway indictments.
And, you know, let me add one little nugget, a little detail that I just learned about these throwaway convictions. You know, there's this Dutch lawyer, Alex van der Zwaan, who's been implicated in the Mueller probe, and he took a guilty plea in February. Well, he reported to prison yesterday at the federal prison camp at Allenwood, Pennsylvania, federal prison in eastern Pennsylvania. He's due to be released on June 4th. So after all this, he got 3 weeks in a minimum security prison camp.
Yeah, I want to read about the Concord case. And this is from CNN. A Russian company accused of interfering in the 2016 presidential election continues to play hardball, meaning that they're pleading not guilty, with special counsel Robert Mueller's team now asking a federal judge to look closely at whether the prosecutors pursued a sham criminal case. Concord Management and Consulting said in a court filing Monday that foreign interference in the elections is, quote, a make-believe crime, close quote. The company accused Mueller of trying to, quote, justify his own existence and needing to, quote, indict a Russian, any Russian, close quote, for political reasons. This is going to be an interesting case, Ted Rall.
It sure is. As someone who's been involved in litigation, I know that it's a long road from this point to getting discovery and much less going to trial. But if this defendant really pushes it and decides to mount an aggressive defense that carries things through to its logical conclusion, it could turn everything upside down.
Yeah. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting also because I saw another article in The Hill today about Mueller. When he was in the FBI, had used the Russian oligarch, the aluminum guy, and had gone against the State Department wishes and used him to try and got the oligarch to pay like $25 million to mount an operation to save an FBI, retired FBI agent who is now working for the CIA, who had been captured by the Iranians. So Mueller has himself been working with these Russians for purposes that when he wanted to, when he was in the FBI. But I think you're right. This Concord case, you know, if they go forward, it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I think the government, the Mueller team, will probably have to either drop the charges, or I think they'll drop the charges before they release certain information, and they'll say it's on the basis that we can't release national security information. We did have the goods on them, but you know, we can't release our national security sources and methods. But it's going to be a big blow for the Mueller team, and this is not being covered very much.
It's not being covered. That, to me, this is the biggest single thing. You have one of the defendants coming in and saying, look, we're not guilty. We want to go to trial. We want to go fast. They're not running away. And they want the evidence. They want to see what's the foundation for the indictment. And Mueller's team was so petrified by this that they actually argued against going forward with a trial on their own indictment with this judge on the basis that they had not properly served the defendant with the charges, because they dropped the charges off at like the Russian prosecutor's office rather than at Concord, and the Russian prosecutor didn't act as their messenger forwarding it to Concord. That was their argument. That's the Mueller team's argument to the judge, and the judge rejected it and said, no, let's go forward. You have an indictment. You have a criminal allegation. Let's have a trial. I mean, this is a big deal. I think it's going to be a really big deal. And they have Reed Smith. Like, somebody has made a decision that they really want this to happen.
Yeah, I think that, you know, they have a good case, and they'll be able to pay. They'll be able to pay lawyers. This is 75% of the battle. Do you have the money to pay the lawyers and get good lawyers? And then you're in the game. And, you know, the guys that Mueller's indicting for lying to the, you know, as John, as you know, ordinary people who have decent lives and decent incomes in the United States cannot afford the lawyers.
Oh, yeah.
to go up against the federal prosecutor. So they can get people to plead guilty to lying to the prosecutor and spend 3 weeks in jail rather than spend $200,000 that they don't have on legal defense. In this case, they got people who are going to have enough money to defend themselves.
Yeah, and for a large part of it, John, as you know, whether you end up pleading guilty to some lesser mm-hmm. charge mm-hmm. or a throwaway charge,
which just about everybody does,
or a perjury, it's about, well, I mean, like, take your case. You, as your lawyers were saying, this can be a blip in your life, or
the defining event of your life.
Or you can go to prison for 20, 30
years. In fact, one of my attorneys said, and I think this is apropos of this situation, he said to me one day, you think that this is about justice. It's not about justice. It's about mitigating damage. And so what you do...
Damage to you.
That's right. What you do, whether you're innocent or guilty, is you just negotiate the best deal with the shortest prison sentence. Because it's not going to get any better than that.
Yeah, but if you have money...
Then it's different. Look at John Edwards. Yeah. Remember his case? I mean, he had millions and millions of dollars to spend on his own defense, and he could go nose to nose with the federal prosecutor and ended up winning his case. But don't forget what ProPublica found, that the federal government wins 98.2% of their cases. And those cases that they lose are usually because the defendants have plenty of money.
Sure. Yeah, it has to be. Yeah, but it, what you said before, too, is also, you know, something to remember, that every government has favorites, you know? And this whole notion of collusion, that's one of the things that the Concord people think, what is collusion? You know, what's the legal definition of this? That's a crime. You know, is it a crime for someone to favor someone else in an election? Even a government. And to make that favor, to argue on their behalf or to put out propaganda of some kind, explicit or implicit on their behalf, this happens all the time.
Well, we had President Obama telling the Brits, if you vote for Brexit, you're going to go back to the queue at the U.S. trade relations. He cut a videotape for Macron. I mean, that's collusion, I guess. I mean, or it's just we have a favorite and we want to say so. And it's not even clear, Ted Rall, to me, even though I had said earlier that a lot of Russians were scared of Hillary Clinton and might have felt better about somebody who said, let's have better relations between the U.S. and Russia. But it's not clear to me at all that that's Putin's position. As Ray McGovern once said in an interview in 2016, he thought Putin would much prefer the devil he knows to the devil he doesn't know. And certainly nobody knew what Donald Trump was capable of, although we're seeing a very, very hostile position towards China. 30 seconds left, Ted.
Agree with you. Putin's point of view seems to be that he just doesn't like chaos, and the unknown always could lead to chaos, and chaos is defined the Trump administration. But there certainly were thinkers within the Kremlin who, particularly on the military side, who were very worried about Hillary Clinton's saber-rattling. And I remember there's a great article in Foreign Policy, well worth looking up if you want to look that up.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And also from New York City by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. And we're joined in studio by Nicole Roussel, a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us on the show, John.
Paul, there's a lot in the news to cover this week. A lot of really interesting, but not just interesting, very important pieces. Let's start with a lawsuit that was filed in South Carolina. There's an inmate who was stabbed 8 times during a riot, and he's filed a suit against the prison system. It says here, though, that's not even really what makes this newsworthy. What makes it newsworthy is that it's yet another in a growing list of lawsuits hoping to spur landmark changes in the prison system. What can you tell us about inmates who are suing prison systems for failing to protect them inside prisons?
Unfortunately, this is a trend that's been going on for at least the past 40 years when prisoners first were basically able to sue prisons and jails. And one of the fundamental duties and obligations of the government when they cage people is to protect them. And that includes from everything from the elements to from staff brutality and guard brutality, as well as from other prisoners. And we know that a lot of prisoners are vulnerable to being attacked and assaulted by other prisoners, as well as by, you know, as well as by staff, either due to developmental disabilities, their gender status, things like that. And it's also one of the things that, unfortunately, prisons generally don't do very well. And as we saw in the case of the uprising in South Carolina, where 7 prisoners were killed, a number of other prisoners were seriously injured. They were stabbed as well. And it pretty much just the wholesale abdication of that duty to protect prisoners. And I think what's interesting about the South Carolina case is that literally the guards were nowhere to be seen. And they either abandoned their posts or ran away and took no steps to regain control of the facility for many hours. And that's the type of thing that's pretty egregious. And unfortunately, it happens all too often around the country, every day, literally.
And we talked a decent amount with you, Paul, about the South Carolina uprising. And early on, you know, you were able to communicate with inmates, and you know, we were aware that it was clear that guards were not there, that they were standing outside, not coming in, not helping, not preventing any of the violence, not caring for any of the people who had already been injured. And so we already knew that, but it is definitely interesting to see in this lawsuit that it absolutely confirms everything we talked about. This individual who's filing the lawsuit, I'm quoting from the suit, was forced to bleed and suffer for several hours before correctional staff finally came onto the wing. And again, we knew that, you know, these were guards just kind of standing outside, not helping, not doing anything, which is, of course, their job.
Absolutely. I think that this is a case where this is a microcosm of what's happening nationally. And this is yet another case where prison officials have failed to protect the prisoners in their care. The only thing that I think is putting this in the media attention is it was in the bigger context of a bigger uprising where seven people were killed and many others were seriously injured. And there was a lot of media attention to it. But this reality plays out in cell blocks and prisons around the country every day. And all, and it's very, very rare for prison officials to be held accountable in these cases.
Absolutely. And early on when we talked with you, it seems like the only reason we were able to really know what was going on in there is because there were so many cell phones that had been snuck into the unit, which was so important. This this case also, this kind of horrible, these kind of horrible conditions, this kind of horrible housing is reflected in another piece of news going on right now that Angola, the notorious prison in Louisiana, formerly a plantation, still in many ways a plantation, lots of agricultural work going on there to cut costs for the Louisiana prison system. They finally closed their notorious Camp J. This Camp J at one time had 400 prisoners in it. It was all for discipline, people in solitary confinement, which we know is not only inhumane and is against international law, but is also completely ineffective for people who have any sort of disciplinary issues or, you know, most often really just mental illness of being in a cage. So, yeah, I mean, this is a great thing that they're closing this. What does this mean, do you think, Paul?
I would say given the kind of lengthy, horrible history of Angola, I'd say probably not much. Either they're changing the name of it or they're just closing down that facility to remodel it and update it or something like that. I mean, I'd say it's great if that's what they're doing, but given their kind of history at evading any type of reform and trying to stay pretty firmly, and they succeeded at staying pretty firmly in the mid-19th century as far as their penal policies and operations go, I think that I'd like to hope that it's part of a bigger change and that, but I think a lot of times what happens in prisons is literally they'll change the name of a unit, or if they close down one unit, the problems that were symptomatic of it, such as brutality or solitary confinement or lack of mental health care and things like that, just get shifted to another unit somewhere else in the facility or another prison within the prison system.
Yeah, I definitely hear you. I mean, closing one wing doesn't mean they're going to get more funding for health care. It doesn't mean they're going to be able to provide any more resources to the people who are there. I do think it is, as you said, a good sign of a little bit more attention being brought to this. It sounds like VERA, which is a kind of a national justice group, is helping, trying to assist the state in, and in other states as well, trying to assist in housing people in more kind of, or I guess less inhumane ways is really the only way to say that. PJI, the Promise of Justice Initiative, which does a lot of conditions issues, they were quoted as saying Camp J was more akin to a dungeon, which was used to house individuals who were more in need of mental health treatment than disciplinary action. And you're right that closing one facility will not actually change the mental health resources available.
And we see that all across America, too. The state of California published a report just a few months ago saying that the number one repository of the mentally ill in the state is the state and local prison system.
Yes, and it's been that way for a long time. I think a lot of sheriffs, I think the sheriff of Los Angeles County said that the L.A. jail is the biggest mental institution in the country, just in terms of mentally ill people getting, and more importantly, in need of mental health services and intervention. So I think that that's kind of, you know, kind of one of the bigger issues there. But I think in some respects, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that solitary confinement facilities and places like Camp J, these are facilities that government officials specifically designed for the purpose of torturing people. They're specifically designed with the goal of making people crazy and destroying people. And I think that that's a far cry, I think, from things that either they're just happening or government officials are reacting or responding to other things outside of their control, which I think in a lot of cases that may happen at the jail level, where jail officials can say, well, you know, we get people off the street or they get arrested and they come into our custody and that. But in the case of the prison officials, things like Camp J, things like Pelican Bay and Corcoran, these are prisons that were specifically designed starting at the architectural level to reduce environmental stimulation with people, to reduce and eliminate human contact. And we've known for 200 years, we've known that these conditions cause insanity and mental illness in people. And that's what they do to people that are mentally sane when they get into them. And with people that are already mentally ill, we know that it just dramatically exacerbates their mental illness and makes them a lot worse, a lot faster. And yet it continues to be done.
That's right. We're speaking from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. And we have with us here in the studio Nicole Russell, a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show. We're talking about criminal injustice. This is our weekly segment where we talk about the conduct of prosecutors, the conduct of courts, and how the justice system denies justice to so many people.
I'm looking at one statistic since we're on the issue of mental health. We've covered this before, but again, it says so much about society, actually, about this society, and also how this society has evolved. Well, how this society has devolved, because what exists now hasn't always been the case. I'm looking at the Department of Justice study, Mental Illness of Prison Inmates. The release today of a study, this isn't today, but I'm reading from it. The release today of a study by the U.S. Department of Justice Bureau of Justice Statistics, BJS, showing that 64% of local jail inmates, 56% of state prisoners, and 45% of federal prisoners have symptoms of serious mental illnesses. Those are staggering numbers, Paul Wright.
They are, and I think that as staggering as they are, I think they understate the scope of the problem. And when they say serious mental illness, I think it's clear, you know, we should be clear for your listeners that this is people that have serious Axis 1 and Axis 2 diagnoses of, you know, very serious mental illness. This isn't just someone that, hey, they're a little quirky or whatever. And generally, I would say that whatever those numbers are, they tend to understate the problem. They tend to be very conservative numbers. They're not really, when you talk to the lawyers that are litigating, systemic denial of mental health services to prison and jail populations, inevitably the numbers of people who are actually seriously mentally ill are much higher than those types of statistics when you're actually getting down into the bushes, so to speak, of, you know, who actually needs the mental health interventions and who actually needs treatment and things like that. The numbers are high based on what the reports say, but they're actually, I think the reality is they are much higher, that if anything, this understates the problem.
I want to completely agree with that. In several states where I've gone through, kind of toured through the intake process, often the way that you get ID'd as being mentally ill is only self-identification. And as we know, there's a ton of stigma around mental health. There's also a lot of vulnerability in being mentally ill, especially if you're in somewhere that's like a prison with no resources, when you're close to a lot of people, when you're kind of in danger by the guards. And so the only way that you're able to access resources is if you specifically say at intake, I have a mental illness. This is what it is. I've been diagnosed in this way. And these are terrible ways to identify mental illness. There's such little access for healthcare, for psychotherapy, for any of the things that we have on the outside that might identify those sorts of things later on. And of course, sitting in cages does not, it only exacerbates what might be going on an underlying level.
Well, I think in some respects, it gets even worse than that, is they take people that they know are mentally ill, they lock them in solitary confinement, which exacerbates their mental illness, and a lot of times this manifests itself with behavioral outbursts, acting out, decompensation, and things like that. And then that's used to either keep them in segregation longer, put them in even more punitive conditions. So you just get into this whole downward spiral of retribution, mental illness, acting out based on the mental illness, and then even more repression and more retribution. And then you wind up usually with people getting killed by the government as a result of their mental illness because they are mentally ill.
Or committing suicide, which if you're being stuck in solitary confinement and having your mental illness exacerbated is also, I would argue, a government killing.
Well, I would agree with that. And I think that's one of the things that's important to note, that the government, when we're talking about the concept of protecting the prisoners in its custody, that includes protecting them from harming themselves. And I think that's also one of the things, too, that a lot of people, I think, need some education on the whole issue of self-harm, because it's not normal for people to kill themselves. And there's a lot of examples where, you know, there's a lot of prison systems that are well-run enough that literally they go for years without any suicides among their prison population. So the notion that somehow suicides are inevitable or that people will always kill themselves or whatever, that just isn't true.
Paul, there was an important piece in Criminal Legal News Magazine, the sister publication of Prison Legal News Magazine, last month. It's timely today. Frankly, it's been timely for many years. And that's the issue of police departments shuffling bad cops around from department to department. There's an example in the article saying that that a policeman in a small township outside of Cincinnati had criminally misused a police computer system to spy on his girlfriend and her ex-boyfriend. And instead of being prosecuted or even fired, he was allowed to resign. And what he did, of course, after resignation was he just went to work for another police department. We see this kind of thing all the time. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is actually, I mean, one of the terms that's been coined, I don't know if it's still in use now, but one of the terms that's been coined is the term gypsy cops. And these are the cops that literally they go from department to department. They get fired. They get fired for abusing their positions, whether it's through excessive force or killing people or brutalizing them, or in this case, misusing police state resources for their own personal ends and things like that. And, you know, they just go to another police department and continue on as if nothing had happened. And, yeah, this is, I think, a huge problem in law enforcement. And it's just kind of a problem. And the big thing is that the agencies that do the hiring for these positions don't actually do much, if anything, in the way of background checks or certifications or anything like that to see what, you know, just to see what the, you know, what the employment history is of the people they're hiring for these positions are.
It seems that this actually isn't surprising, not because we have known that this happens in many places, but also because the role of the police in the society is to protect the interests, you know, the interests of the capitalist class. So having these sorts of violent histories is maybe even a good thing for what they're, you know, for their goal of brutalizing people, of keeping people down, of terrorizing. I mean, in that way, it actually matches fairly closely to the actual goal of the police.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And no one is saying that this is, no one is saying or claiming that this is somehow a problem or a bar to employment or that they shouldn't be doing this as a result of it. So the other thing, too, is, you know, we can also note that this isn't just the police issue, too. This also comes up with school teachers and coaches that sexually assault their students and things like that. So it's kind of, I think, in some respects, it's almost a bigger bureaucratic state problem beyond just the police state problem.
That's a great point. It seems like background checks are used very specifically against people in the working class, against people who need jobs, against people who have left prison, who didn't have money to hire a fancy attorney who could keep them out. It's used mostly to keep people from, you know, hourly jobs, just trying to make ends meet.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're talking this week, as we do every Thursday, about the criminal injustice system. We take a look at the cops, the prisons, the courts, and the manifest ways in which people are denied justice in the United States. And of course, what we're talking about are not like just bad apples, although right now we're talking about some really bad apples. We're talking about a system. We're talking about a system where the whole barrel is rotten, and the apples are functioning within it. We're talking with Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News, PLN. And we're joined in studio by Nicole Roussel. She's a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. And Nicole also has done for many years a great deal of work around and about the criminal injustice system. Paul Wright, you're in Florida, and it's almost hurricane season. I noticed on your website you have an important article called In the Eye of the Storm, When Hurricanes Impact Prisons and Jails. I mean, we're talking about Angola. That's Louisiana. Of course, you know, we know what happened in 2005. Last year, more big hurricanes. What does happen to prisoners in the prisons and jails and penitentiaries when hurricanes hit?
Well, unfortunately, everything that you would expect would happen to populations that are not evacuated, that are not appropriately sheltered, often in decrepit buildings that really aren't hurricane resistant, and that's basically viewed as an expendable population. And the other thing, too, is lest we think that this is just a problem in the Deep South, let's just remember that when Hurricane Sandy hit New York, Mayor Bloomberg made a big point of saying that no one was going to be evacuated from Rikers Island, and it didn't really matter what happened. And that's what I think is kind of like the bigger problem with how prisoners are viewed in this context in the face of natural disasters, whether it's hurricanes, tornadoes, flooding, all of which we report on a regular basis in Prison Legal News, is that in general, the evacuation of prisoners, if it even happens, is very much of an afterthought. And this is also part of the problem, too, of, you know, where a lot of these prisons and jails have been built and constructed. You know, you've got cases where they've been built in floodplains, they've been built in basically areas that no commercial developer would build anything in because they're so unsafe. And yet this is where government agencies have chosen to build prisons. And I think that just kind of illustrates, I think, is one problem being compounded by another. But, you know, we've just seen case after case after case when natural disaster strikes, prisoners are left at best to fend for themselves and hope for the best.
Absolutely. In these scenarios, too, in evacuation scenarios, you also see women kind of getting the short end of the stick where, you know, you might get divided up. It could end up with you being in solitary, especially if you're a woman and you need to be in max security. You can end up being in solitary in some man's prison, which doesn't make matters any better, as we were talking about with solitary earlier. Speaking of solitary, Trump recently also rolled back rules that had been put into place to protect transgender prisoners from sexual assault. In this policy shift, the Trump administration essentially is now requiring facilities to match, rather than a gender identity, to match the biological sex for your assignment. So this means that people who identify as, people who have lived life as, people who dress as, may have had realignment surgery, gender confirmation surgery, to be the gender of that they identify with, have to go to a prison with people who are of their former identity, of their former gender. And this can be incredibly dangerous. Have you seen, I'm sure you've seen news about this, Paul.
Yes, we have. And in some respects, it's unfortunately, the treatment of transgender prisoners has been so bad for so long in American prisons that unfortunately this isn't like a market deviation abound. In fact, one of the leading Supreme Court cases on the government's failure to protect prisoners is a case called Farmer versus Brennan. And D. Farmer, who was the plaintiff in that case, was a transgender prisoner who was transitioning from male to female, and she was housed in a maximum security men's prison where she was raped. And the Supreme Court came in their decision held that where they set forth kind of the standard for holding prison officials responsible and liable for these attacks, one of the things that they came up with was that the risk, basically for prison officials to be held liable, the risk has to be obvious. And even the Supreme Court thought that it was pretty obvious that holding transgender prisoners in maximum security male prisons, that the risk was obvious that they would be at a heightened risk of sexual assault. And so, yeah, so that's kind of like the standard, but, and that was a federal prison case too. So that wasn't a state case. And, but since then, prison officials have pretty much steadfastly resisted and denied doing anything about transgender prisoners in terms of, you know, their safety. All too often they're held in segregation, ostensibly for their own protection, rather than the idea that, that they should, rather than with the idea that they should be housed in facilities that are appropriate for their gender, and that by doing that, they'll be probably inherently safer otherwise. So, you know, these are all, you know, these are all problems that have been longstanding, and this, and they long precede Donald Trump becoming president. So I'm not really sure if, you know, when things have been bad, so bad for so long, I'm not really sure if, you know, this is a market increase or not, or just more of a continuation of a bad, you know, of a bad normal level of bad.
Paul, you know, I'm trying to look a little bit more into the stats behind violence against transgender people in prison. We know from many, many stories that the violence is very large and overwhelming, and that most and many people who are transgender who go to prison are very vulnerable to violence. But I actually am not finding a ton of data.
Yeah, and I don't think that's surprising, because actually just in terms of the actual data that's been collected on violence against prisoners, very little of it comes from government sources. And again, as far as like breaking it down by gender status, there hasn't really been a lot of research done on that. I think the closest that you get is when researchers have talked to individual transgender prisoners, and they've asked them about their experiences of incarceration along the lines of, you know, have you been sexually harassed? Have you been assaulted or threatened with assault? That's when you get kind of anecdotal reporting about that, and the overwhelming numbers that, yes, they have. But that also gets us into some of the research that's been done by Just Detention International around, and also by the Stop Prison Rape Commission, or by the Prison Rape Elimination Act Commission, finding that the levels of sexual assault and sexual intimidation in American prisons are stunningly high. Where what government research has been done on this, even though it's not broken down by gender specifics or gender or for transgender prisoners, they find that, you know, 25-30% of prisoners report being sexually assaulted. This is like within the previous year. It's not even like throughout the course of their incarceration or whatever. And, you know, so the rates of sexual assault for all prisoners in the U.S. are stunningly high. And then I think just when you start zeroing in or honing in on transgender prisoners, those numbers go even higher.
Have we seen any big improvements since PREA has been passed?
I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the things to remember is that the key thing about PREA is that it's a data collection act for the most part, and that data is self-reported by the prisons and jails. It's not like anyone's auditing the objective accuracy of the data. And it took the DOJ over a decade to actually implement the PREA standards. And by the time they were actually implemented, they were so watered down by the prison industry that I think that for the most part, they're fairly meaningless.
I was touring a Louisiana jail, and I was with a kind of a PREA expert who made it very clear that all of the things we were seeing, which were, to be clear, someone in plain view of the guards just walking down the hallway. I was walking down the hallway as a woman in a man's facility. I was seeing someone on the toilet. I was seeing someone showering. I was seeing all sorts of things that I was not prepared to see, and that I have to imagine the men behind the glass were not prepared for a woman or any stranger to see. And these are years and years after these PREA standards have been passed.
Well, but I think that what you're describing, though, I think the biggest thing about that is the dehumanization of prisoners. They're not viewed as humans that have a right to privacy or a right to human dignity. That, I think, is the biggest takeaway from that. And that even gets beyond the safety thing about, you know, should they be protected from sexual assault or rape? But again, I think this is the whole thing of, you know, they're not entitled to the concept of dignity, that they should be able to use a toilet in privacy rather than being in full view of whatever stranger happens to be touring the prison at the time. Back in the 70s, is a term that kind of fell out of favor. I'm not sure why, but among radical activists, the term zoo prison, you know, was used.
That's apropos. You know, Paul, we're running out of time. Before we go out, though, we want to find out, how can people support your organization, Prison Legal News? How can they learn about it?
Well, the big thing is go to our website, prisonlegalnews.org, as well as criminallegalnews.org. We have the biggest repositories of criminal justice information available anywhere online. People can subscribe. They can make donations. They can buy books from us. And, of course, let folks know about us.
Well, that was the voice of Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News magazine. And here in studio, we had Nicole Russell, a Sputnik News analyst and the producer of this show. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.